Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Well, welcome everybody to today's live show, the Open Forum, where we do our best to field tax and legal questions from around the country, around the world, as the case may be from time to time. I'm your host with my amazing co-host, Matt Sorensen.
Welcome. Yeah, so excited to be here. And we do have, you know, listeners around the world. I know I was chuckling there, but we have a big listener base in Ireland for whatever reason. I don't know how we got that, yeah. But we got some fans in Ireland.
We should look and see where that the little scatter plot of our listeners are recently. But our call-ins have been from servicemen and women from abroad. They're based somewhere, and they're calling in on the show or emailing a question, and they're coming back to a rental property or a small business. It can happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome everybody. So you may feel like this is a little ghetto podcast for you. You love these crisp, sweet recorded podcasts that are produced with millions of dollars of corporate backing. We're just coming to you live. This is live, so we can take our call-ins, and it's once a month on average, once every 3 weeks. And so we can't take live callers if we do the recorded sexy podcast editing. So Blog Talk Radio becomes our platform for this, and want to ask for your patience. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, but it's still pretty good. I mean, it's focus on the content, you know. Just focus on the content, not the scratchy sound. But, so if you're new to the show, get to refreshyourwealth.com. You can check out prior shows. I had some people, you know, this is weird. Friends of mine will find the show and text me and be like, I actually listen to your podcast and like it. I'm like, thanks. for those, you know, friends listening, I appreciate it. Give us a 5-star review for reals. But this is about tax and legal planning, living the American dream. Mark and I are both lawyers. We wrote some books. We run our own businesses, buy real estate. I mean, we're just out there, you know, doing the same thing a lot of our clients are. And so we feel like we have a lot of good context for the questions that come in, and hopefully can say something smart every once in a while.
Yeah, we try. There's a golden nugget in every show. You just got to wait for it. It'll just kind of slap you in the face.
You got to mind
like,
for
wow.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I saved thousands with that last little tip. One last note on our listeners, and we're going to jump into it. Matt, it was kind of funny. Last week, my wife was driving to Salt Lake, which is about a 4-hour drive from where we're at, and my daughter and her are working on a little rehab. That'll be a rental, and she's been down there almost all week, going crazy, just buying cabinets and painting and tile guys are in there, and she's knee deep in it. It's like Chip and Joanna, except I'm Chip, but in another state. It was very well planned by me. I want to say
nice job.
But it is funny. We've got a little rental here in our small town in Idaho that my daughter, I just literally, before I jumped on the show, was like, I need you over there painting today. She's like, I don't want to paint over there. Teenagers. But anyway, my wife is driving down there last week, and she's like, Mark, I'd never listened to your podcast before. I binged on it the whole drive. I go, what? You listen to the show? Because she'd be like, I don't need to hear you. I hear enough of you. And she's like, you and Matt were kind of funny. She goes, I was loving the show. I didn't know you were so smart. This is my wife telling me after 10 years of doing a podcast. She's like, I kind of like the show. You were funny. You're really smart. I go, thanks, honey. I'm like, wow. And then she goes, you were talking about me on the show. I go, well, just once or twice. So now I've got to watch what I say. So, Jen, I'm dedicating the show to you. I love you. You're the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. that out of the way.
I want to dedicate the show. I love that. It's the old school call-in.
Yeah.
I'd like to give a shout-out to my girl. Can you play Tears for Fears, you know, whatever. Get put in your request.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well,
okay.
We do have a lot of questions. You can call in today. Keep in mind, live callers get priority. Mark's, what's the call number? 646?
The call, yep, 646-668-8326. I'll repeat that, 646-668-8326. And it's the same call-in number every open forum show. If you have our 2020 business owner calendar where we give you important tax data, tax deadlines, some great sections to write your strat plan and business plan every month and quarter, you'll love that calendar. The dates are in there. Also on refreshyourwealth.com, the dates for our open forum show are there. And when you get in the queue, press the number 1, and our sexy host will jump off to the side and, you know, get your name and then welcome you on the show.
Just in case anybody thinks there was some sexual harassment going on there with Mark. Mark is the sexy assistant taking those calls. Just, you know.
That's right.
Yeah, don't anyone misunderstand there. It's still a true statement, though. Still a true statement.
And we'll say this, too. We've got a lot of email questions, and we won't be able to get to all of them. We're going to sometimes there'll be 3 or 4 questions around the same topic, so we'll be able to knock out several birds with one stone. But if not, Matt and I will do our best to stay up late while we're watching a little Netflix tonight and return some emails and just give you a quick answer, send you to a video. And a lot of times some of your questions may just need a 30-minute consult with one of our tax lawyers that could point in the right direction. Our accounting firm is well underway, so busy. So we have to be careful assigning time to our accountants right now during tax season to answer some of your questions. But you may want to book some time. It can be very affordable just to book a little time if we don't get to your question. All right, Matt. Well, we don't do our tax or legal tip on our open forum show, so we're going to get right to it. We're 7.5 minutes in. We're answering questions. I think that's pretty darn efficient. So we're going to do our best. Matt, why don't you hit lead
I agree.
Off. What do you got?
I agree. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, this is a question from Eric in Washington. And he's got a couple questions, but I think these are great ones to start off with. Says, I am 1099, employed working this year and to start a company and start my retirement, and he's 39 years old. Looking to also invest in mobile homes, should I put it in an LLC or under my name? Hopefully put one in both when I have enough doors. My goal is to get a door every month. That's going to be my business license name. Okay, all right. Well, I just gave that out. Hopefully no one's running there to steal your name, Eric. But so keep in mind, you know, when you email these questions,
these
in, they're on
forum.
Attorney client privilege. I mean, yeah, you get the point here. all right, well, this is great. So Eric's starting a new business, going to be doing mobile homes, wants to buy one a month. I love that. Get after it. The question, though, about put it in an LLC or under my name, we generally are going to say use an LLC for liability protection. These mobile homes, you're generally going to have rental income from the mobile homes. And we don't want them in your personal name. I mean, mobile homes, even though they're a lower value, there's not a lot of equity there. They're higher risk in terms of tenants, so it's more mm-hmm. likely someone's going to sue you in a mobile home than they are your typical single-family rental in the, you know, average middle America neighborhood. So I'm really more concerned about liability protection, which is why I would like an LLC, because the way the LLC works, most people know this, but just in case you don't, if the LLC owns the mobile home, the tenant in the mobile home slips and falls or whatever, or something happens, they want to sue you. They can't sue you. They can't come after you personally. They can't get into your retirement account, can't go after your home, can't garnish your paycheck. They can't sue you personally. They can only sue the LLC. And you have that limited liability protection, also sometimes called the corporate veil. So I'd use the LLC, and you can use multiple LLCs as you grow and have enough doors. We generally would start splitting that out. Once you have enough equity, 250 grand of equity is when we'll look at doing multiple LLCs. So that's where I'd start. There's some other tax planning and stuff you might look at, but I would start, as to your question, just getting an LLC in place for liability protection.
Okay, and two side notes. I just recorded two YouTube videos that went live yesterday, and they're talking about the corporate veil and the LLC protection of the corporate veil and how to maintain it. They're quick to the point. There's more reading material and longer videos in the Tax and Legal Library on our sites. But those YouTube videos are free. Check them out. I think they're about 9 minutes apiece. Share them on your social media. We'd appreciate that. But get over there, Eric, and watch those videos. I think that'll help too. Second side note is we're going to jump to the next question with Allison, and she's asking a question very similar. So this is kind of 1099's rental property and 199A. So this is tricky, everybody. She says, if I'm a landlord claiming the Section 199A qualified deduction for my residential rental property on Schedule E, qualifying under the safe harbor provision, I'm not sure what you mean safe harbor there, but do I need to send out Form 1099s to my independent contractors? Now, Allison throws out two or three incredibly deep topics in one question. I got to hand it to you, Allison. That was fun. So the first thing is, some people are listening going, what is this, 199A? This is the qualified income tax deduction that is a 20% deduction on your earned income in a small business or a real estate project. It's something that the GOP and Trump gave to Main Street businesses in this legislation that just passed 2 years ago. It's a pretty cool deal. So if you make money in your small business, you get a 20% deduction right off the top. What? Really good stuff. Now, business owners should be aware of this and planning on it. And I've got, again, lots of reading. Chapter 6 of my second edition book that just came out after the Tax Reform Act really breaks it down. That's the Tax and Legal Playbook. Now, can you get that on your rental property? Yes. But if your rental property is losing money, that doesn't apply because you lost money. And Allison, here's the part you're not going to like, and this is part of your second question that I'm just going to hit, is she says, if I lose money, do I still get to the 199A next year? Yes, but your losses carry forward under the 199A schedule. So it's kind of weird. So if you've got several small businesses and you've got a loss in one business and a gain in another business, they're netted together. If you have a loss entirely, with which you might on paper with real estate, even though it's making money, which is a great strategy, you're going to carry that loss forward and net it against gains in the future, then get the 199A. Very deep topic. I'm just going to leave it at that for everybody. Don't careen off the side of the road. Our podcast is not that deep on a regular question. But the 199A is a big deal, so go check it out and study it up a little bit more, Allison. The last thing she said that has nothing to do with 199A is she says, do I need to send out 1099s to my independent contractors? Now, this is a great topic this time of year in January. And when there was a few other emails that came in on this. So I'm just going to say it now. If you own a small business and you hire a subcontractor and you pay them more than $600, you've got to issue them a 1099, maybe. And you may say, well, what do you mean maybe? Well, whenever you pay a subcontractor, you always have them fill out a W-9. So when you go get a new job, you fill out a W-4. When you are doing a new business, when you hire a business owner, you give them a W-9. The W-9 fills out some important information, like their tax ID number, and they are going to check certain boxes, which will tell you if you need to issue them a 1099. So if you own a rental property business and you're hiring a plumber to come in and work on your rental property and you paid them more than $600, you're required to send them a 1099 generally, unless they check the box for a corporation, you don't have to. And I've got an article on this on the blog. The blog this month, there's an article on 1099s. And people, these are due at the end of January. Now, let me repeat this. Everybody listening, I had a realtor, quick example, that had paid a bunch of people, never gave them 1099s. She and her husband got audited for not issuing 1099s. The penalties were $13,000. Now, we were able to get her out of that after a number of legal hours, a lot of begging. negotiating and dealing with the auditor. It was touch and go. If you screw up these 1099s, there's a big penalty. So as business owners, you've got to issue these. And the IRS is getting tougher and tougher on this. California is all over this with a new law that we've got articles coming out on. So you've got to get your 1099s out this month. We have paralegals and accountants that can help with this. Call the office, get it done. You cannot just do it online. You cannot just go to Turbo or print it out and be done with it. It takes several steps, and you can't do it on January 31st and think you're okay. Get it started now. Whew. Sorry, Matt. Ugh, that was a big one. Allison threw out like a bunch of twists and turns on that one.
Yeah, you got a little preachy at the end there. Not going to lie.
I know.
you know, I just got my 1099s in on Monday, so I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Ooh, wow.
A little ahead of it, not trying to brag or anything, but yeah. All right. Well, this is a question from Claire in Nashville, Tennessee. That is one of the coolest cities I've never been to that I've always wanted to go to. Everybody tells me it's amazing. And I've never been. Have you been to Nashville?
I have. I drove by the Grand Ole Opry. That's in Nashville,
okay.
Right? Am I missing something? And
I don't know. I've never been. I think you're right, though.
Yep. And then I kept going. I stopped and had some good barbecue, which is critical.
Okay.
And there was a little jazz band playing, had some barbecue, and then I hit the road and kept going. But it's pretty cool.
Okay.
So,
all right. Well, Claire asked a question on privated transactions. Oh, did you?
Well, I'm really a little concerned that I really screwed that up because I just want to make sure that I'm not. Nashville, Tennessee, Grand Ole Opry. I was flying into Arkansas or somewhere, and flew into Tennessee and then drove to Arkansas, and I'm like, did I just screw that up? I've only been there once. Okay, no, we're good. Okay, Matt,
okay.
You continue with your question, and I'm going to talk to a live caller here and get them out on the line.
All right, sounds good. Okay, so Claire asked about privated transaction exemptions. She says, can you address the process briefly on how to request an IRS exemption pertaining to a self-directed IRA? Transacting with a disqualified person, for example, our children. We would like to invest in our son's real estate business, but we are prohibited due to the fact that he's a disqualified person, so the transaction would be prohibited. All right, great question. Yes, and I think some people are surprised by this. There is actually a prohibited transaction exemption process that you can go through with the IRS to say, hey, I know if I invest my IRA in my son's business, my son's a disqualified person, I know that'd be a prohibited transaction, but I still want to do it. Will you let me do it? There are instances where the IRS will allow you to do that, and they will give you a specific exemption. So now there are standard, what are called privated transaction exemptions themselves that apply to everybody, but you'll generally do this through a DOL advisory opinion, or you can do it, which you probably wouldn't do in this question scenario. The DOL advisory opinion is more like, hey, is what I'm trying to do prohibited or not? We know yours is. Or you can get a private letter ruling with the IRS relying on a privy transaction exemption to say, hey, we want to do this. We know it's prohibited, but we still think there's good reason that it should be allowed. I don't think in your example that is one that why the IRS would allow you to do that. There's just what's the reason for that? You just want to invest in your son's business? You think maybe he's going to be more successful than anyone else in investing your IRA dollars? I don't know. But I don't know that would be a good one. I have actually helped clients with this. I had one client where they actually owned real estate in their retirement account, and they wanted to use it in their business themselves. And they had a good business reason why this real estate was important, and it could be used in their personal business. And it was adjacent to other property that they personally owned. But anyways, we were able to get a privy transaction exemption for that. Now, it cost them about $10,000 in legal fees. We had to get an appraisal. They had to get a third-party broker involved, and there were some steps. And it also took about 9 months. So it is possible to get those, but it's going to cost you maybe on the low end $5,000 if you've got one that the IRS has approved before for someone else. They have a kind of an expedited process for that. If it's like, hey, you give this to someone else, because they publish all of them. I'm just trying to do the exact same thing. But there's a way to actually do this. you would think we do more of them, but because of the time delay, most people want to do transactions now. You generally don't see them happening. So.
Okay. All right. I'm going to throw this out real quick as we before we go to our live caller. We've got Tim who says, I'm 58, and is it too late for me to start a Roth account? And the answer is no. You can start a Roth account at any age. You just have to have earned income. So get out there. If you're still breathing, you got time to start a Roth. And I'd frankly reach out to your children or grandchildren and say, I was thinking of opening a Roth in for you. Give me the money. Because if my grandma called me, well, my grandma's passed, but if my mom called me and said, hey, I'm going to open a Roth this weekend, I'll make you the beneficiary. I'm like, I'll give you the money. Put it in. Because when she dies, I get what's called the stretch IRA, and I inherit her Roth, which is really cool. Whole topic, but any age, whole different topic.
Mm-hmm.
You can start a Roth account at any age. So you're good to go, Tim. Okay, we got Joe on the line from Colorado. So, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You bet you, sir.
You bet.
Higher rate
for
question, if I understand.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the question is, I have a self-directed IRA that's connected to
mm-hmm.
a checking account for my LLC account that I bought real estate with this year. And I had some contractors, a plumber and a driveway guy that I had to that I paid him more than $600. So even though
okay.
it's a self-directed IRA and it's LLC, do I need to give them the 1099?
Hmm.
Yes.
Good
Simple
question.
Answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good question. The answer is yes. Matt, do you want to elaborate, or I mean, anything?
Yeah, I remember I looked at this a couple of years ago to see if there's any exemption for it. I didn't find any, so I'm not aware of an exemption on the 1099s.
Okay.
When you're using the LLC, I mean, you're kind of the paying party, so you'd be responsible to issue that from the LLC. So, unfortunately, yes. If it's over 600.
Well, it's good to know then. I'll get a
yeah.
hold of you guys.
And
yeah.
And let me throw this out, folks, and I'll finish commenting off the line. But, Joe, thanks for calling in. It's good. Appreciate you. Stay on the line. I've got a couple
okay,
of comments,
yeah.
too. Thank you, okay. sir. I would say this to everybody. Remember, why are we issuing 1099s? The thing is, the IRS wants people to not get paid under the table. That's it. If you're going to take a write-off, if Joe wants a write-off for paying this plumber in his IRA LLC someday, or maybe he doesn't even need the write-off, but the IRS wants to know who Joe paid. And the only way they can police this is by having Joe get a W-9 for any subcontractor he pays and then issuing a 1099 by the end of January the following year. That's it. It's not terribly hard. It's just kind of a little pain in the butt you got to do every January. And I think our office is $30 or $50 to start it, and then it's like $2 or $3 per 1099. It's not terribly expensive. And you can walk into any H&R Block or whatever, but you have to do it in paper or electronic. There's two different ways to do it. It's not as simple as you think. Just click, 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 I'm done. So talk to your accountant. Get a company involved to help you knock it out. And, Joe, you just do a little report and find out all the people who paid. And you should be getting W-9s. From everybody that you pay anyway. If you're like, well, I never got a W-9. Well, that bozo may not be claiming the money you paid him. And so they hold you accountable for not doing it. They don't even know who this person is without you. So that's why they go after the owner.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, and a lot of companies will issue you an invoice, and they'll give you their tax ID on the invoice, you know, so you could use it to do the 1099s. It's better to get an actual W-9 form, and you know, but a lot of them will give you their tax ID, and they know you need it to issue a 1099 at the end of the year. So a lot of companies throw that on their invoicing.
Okay. I like it. Now, before we go to another live caller, and while Matt hits an IRA question, if that's acceptable, we've got Amber with a question, and she says, Mark, I've heard you talk about paying your children by doing an online banking and just transferring accounts, transferring money into their accounts. Because if you want to say you paid your kids, young or old, you got to actually do it. You got to move the money. You got to follow the paper trail. You got to launder it. You got to do it. So legitimately, of course, your kids are working in the business. Now, she said, I cannot find any bank that will let my kids have an account with a card. I was advised, you know, debit card. I was advised to just put the money into a savings account and then go buy cash cards at the bank. It's not easy because both branches are 30 minutes away and so packed every time. This is a pain in the rear. What do I do? Okay, a few thoughts for everybody out there that's a parent trying to get their kids on payroll. So Amber's obviously talking about children under age 18 because it's easy for your older children to go get a bank account. So when you have kids that are under age 18, let me give a few tips. Wells Fargo has a teen checking account. They will set up for the teenager to have a debit card. They start at age 13. In the good old days, they do it for anybody. But the Wells Fargo and the bigger banks like B of A and Chase, they're a little hesitant giving bank accounts with debit cards strictly in the name of children under age 12. Now, they'll do it if you push hard enough and talk to the right personal banker and all this. But your average 19-year-old at the desk at Chase is not going to know what to do. And then they call the bank manager in, and it's a big to-do. So here's if your kids are under age 13, what I think is the easiest thing to do is open a joint account. Just open a joint checking account. Put the kid on as a signer, and then they can take that debit card and run with it. And if the bank won't even make your kid a signer on the account, you make it the kid's account. And for now, and you dedicate it to that child, and that child has that debit card. And yes, your name's on it, but they could use that debit card at school for lunches. You're going to use that debit card or checkbook that comes with it to pay for soccer, school clothes, and all that. So as long as you, worst case scenario, dedicate a checkbook to the kid, and you're the only signer on it for now because that's the only way you could get your bank to do it, then fine. It's okay. But I do want you to try to get the kid on as a signer, get them their own debit card with their name on it, which most banks are going to do even if they're younger. This savings account, cash card, don't go down that path. Just dedicate accounts to them, and I think you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. I know you'll be fine. The IRS is what the IRS is worried about more. Now, they still want to show that you paid the kid, but what they're more worried about is what work did they do, and did you overpay them? So let's just be legit. Let's get the kids involved, and let's start paying them. Mm-hmm. Let's start funding Roth IRAs. Oh, my gosh, pay for school clothes, school lunch. The tax write-offs are freaking amazing. I was just at the gym this morning, and my personal trainer, and we were there on the weekend. I was boxing. I'm boxing now. It's pretty cool. I'm just talking kickboxing. I'm getting in the ring.
I was wondering when you were going to drop this on the Refresh Your Wealth show. Oh, here it comes. Okay, Mark Holler in the ring. When is the first match?
You know,
is there going to be a match? Can you, like,
yes.
Fight someone?
Okay. Yes. Okay, now I fight right now. Okay, now this is my trainer. We get in the ring and we do 3 2-minute rounds. And sometimes he'll be like, you just hit me. You hit me, I will not hit back for one round. This guy's fast. I mean, he's done MMA. He's all this. He's freaking hard to hit. He's like, you hit me as hard as you want. He's got headgear on. I got headgear. You know, I'm trying to hit him. I'm like, stop moving. So I'm trying to hit him. And then the next round, he's like, yeah, I'm going to punch back. I'm not going to hit you too hard, but, you know, I'm going to hit you back. And I'm like, boom, what? So, I mean, it keeps going. It's so amazing. Such a good workout. By the third round, I'm ready to pass out. I'm like, these boxing, it's a dance. I've learned so much about boxing. In a nutshell, we spar, and he said, now here's the cool part. The owner of the gym is he and his wife, and I was going to bring this up. I was there one afternoon, and they had their kids come in at 3 o'clock on a Saturday and started cleaning the gym. They're mopping, they're cleaning, and all their kids, they were from age 5 to 12 or 13. I'm like, this is awesome. That's a tax write-off. And I was telling my trainer, you got to be paying them off. And they're like, what? Our accountant has never brought that up. I'm like, oh, my gosh. So half the time I'm getting boxing training, we're talking about taxes. But anyway, in a summary, Matt, because he's a cop, they have a training they do with the new recruit officers, and they bring them in, and they give through a round of some boxing training so the cops can know how to throw a punch or take a punch if they have to. And he goes, we're doing a sparring night where we're going to let people, you know, go in the round for a little bit and not try to prove their manhood and someone gets hurt. And he goes, y'all come. He goes, these cops would love to hit a lawyer. I'm like, I don't know if we want to throw that out.
They'd be all into that.
I'm like,
oh, man,
okay,
we could sell a lot of tickets.
Sign up to hit a lawyer. They all jump up. Me.
Yeah, I smell a charity event. I see a charity event in here, you know. But we can sell a lot of tickets.
Yeah, we can sell tickets. Yeah. Anyway, I just love the little gym they own, and it's a family business, and they're paying their kids. And so,
yeah.
Amber, that's where I was going with all that is we really need to think about it. Okay, Matt, you take an IRA question. We've got a couple of callers I'm going to go grab and see what they're up to.
Yeah. All right, I was going to say, I'm going to add one other comment to this, too, on paying the kids, which do it with my kids. For me, I liked it when they turned 13. That's when I started paying them, and it kind of worked naturally to what I could get the bank account for them. And it was a good process for me. And this, for anyone with kids, is go to the bank with your kids. Don't just go open the bank account yourself. Go in there with them.
Yeah.
Let them sit down. Talk to the bank representative. They, you know, most of the bankers love to kind of do this with the kids that are there opening their first bank account. And I think it's just a good process for your kids to understand, you know, and this is how it works. You actually have to go here. You need to have some identification. They're going to ask you questions. Like, this is part of, like, teaching your children to become adults. And not that you just do it yourself and open it and magically throw money in their account. So I think that 13 is a great age for it anyways. And I also just want to make sure everyone understands. You're in a higher tax bracket. You own a business. If that income's flowing through to you, you're paying tax on it. Take a deduction for it. Pay your kids. They're generally in a zero tax bracket. They won't even need to file a tax return up to like 12 grand now. So it can be a great tax write-off. You just got to keep it legit and, as Mark says, launder the money.
I love it.
Okay, let me hit an IRA question now.
Okay.
This is a two-parter. It's a two-parter from Chetan, who emailed in and says, how do I determine the value of a promissory note I have in my self-directed IRA? Do I use the principal balance as the value, or do I have to take into consideration value of potential interest, even if the IRA doesn't have it at the time? All right. Great question. The value of a promissory note is current principal amount owed, and you have to take it at any date and time. So a lot of times you're having to update your IRA account at the end of the year, so let's say December 31, 2019. So we want to look, what's a note worth on December 31st, 2019? It is the principal owed plus accrued and unpaid interest. That's it. That's what the IRS wants for retirement account assets, is principal owed plus accrued and unpaid interest. That's it. Now, if you have a defaulted note or something like that, those get a little more dicey if you're trying to reduce the value because it's in default. You're generally going to get some type of broker or someone involved or a collection attorney that can state what value is when it's kind of a non-performing note. But performing notes, a note in good standing, just take principal balance plus accrued and unpaid interest. The second question, though, was about the stretch IRA. It says, Chetan says, the stretch IRA is dead. Maybe you can do a show on changes to consider for one's retirement planning. We'd love to hear thoughts on the subject. So, yes, we talked about that a little bit last week. I had a blog article. It was in the newsletter as well. The stretch IRA it's not dead. I don't know why I call it dead. It has been limited. But I kind of, as I've been thinking about it more, I'm not trying to be half glass full. I kind of like it. What they've changed, you used to, when you inherit an account from a non-spouse, if you inherit an account from a spouse, it just becomes your IRA. It's easy. But if you inherit from a non-spouse, let's say your parents or an uncle or whatever, friend, family member, not a spouse, you get what's called an inherited IRA or beneficiary IRA. And under the old rules, you could take that account and you take distributions over your lifetime. So if you're 30 when you inherited or 40, you've got another 50 years that you get to stretch out that as a retirement account and pull money out whenever you want, but you don't have to. You get to keep stretching it out. And so people call that a stretch IRA. That's the rule that was gutted. But
okay. What
they did, let me say this, they gave you 10 years. You still get 10 years, and you don't have to take distributions of it. You can just wait the whole end of the 10 years, keep investing it. So you're still able to stretch 10 years. And I think that's a really important point to just not miss, is the stretch IRA is not dead. It's just been limited to 10 years. And it's been made a little more flexible because you don't have to take distributions every year. You just have to have it all distributed by the end of 10. So you can hold off until the end of 10 years to distribute.
All right. Love it. Okay, Matt, we're going to go to a live caller. This is Mike in Iowa. And Mike, I'm going to let you pose the question again, just so our listeners can hear it directly from you. He kind of threw it out there to me, and I cut him off. So, Mike, tell us about your tax strategy, paying taxes.
Yes. My question is, I was looking at paying the estimated taxes and wanted to use one of my credit cards that provides 2% cash back, and the process for the transaction I would pay the estimated taxes in charges 1.87%, and I am in approximately a 34% tax bracket between federal and state. So I was wondering, is it wise for me to use my credit card if the tax fees, one, were deductible, and two, is if the 2% cash back I get is non-taxable?
Woo, man. Okay, you're breaking up. That was
a little arbitrage here.
I don't know who you are. That's a really hard question. See you later. Bye. No. just joking, Mike.
You guys are amazing.
Oh, you're so kind. I'm just joking around with you. That's a hard question. Okay, good stuff. Now, Mike, let me ask a follow-up question. Are these estimated tax payments for your basic 1040 tax liability, or are these for taxes in your business possibly? Are you a business owner? Are these tax payments related to your business?
Yes, I do own a business. I actually own a small hotel, and these are estimated taxes that I would pay for my 1040 is what I'm paying for.
Do you have other income besides? Yeah. Do you have other income besides business income?
No, I do not have any other income than the hotel. The hotel provides me a W-2, a small
Mark, he's got a hotel on Park Place. He doesn't. You don't need to have anything else. He's got Boardwalk and Park Place. He's got a hotel.
I'm just asking. Jeez. I'm trying to get all the facts here. Jeez. Gosh, heaven forbid. I want to give, some accurate information here. Okay.
Okay.
All right. I love that Mike's bringing up actually two or three tricky topics. So I'm just going to hit these briefly and try to – and I feel confident we can answer these accurately. Okay. Let's do the easy stuff first. When you pay for your business expenses on a credit card – and we're going to assume for a minute that these taxes are a business expense. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. But that whenever you pay for any expense out of your business on your credit card, you can earn points or cash back. The points accrue tax-free, and when you redeem those points, they're tax-free. On some cashback cards, they do not send you a 1099. You just get cash back. And if the IRS does not – sorry. If the credit card company does not issue you a 1099 for those cash back rewards, then it is assumed to be tax-free. You're not required to try to go peel through your credit card statements for the year and figure out what they are. But a lot of credit card companies, Capital One in particular, that are giving cash back, at the end of the year, they want a deduction for that cash back, and they're going to typically issue a 1099 miss for the cashback they issue you. So if you get the 1099, you got to claim it. If you don't, and this is somewhat of a gray area because it's kind of up to what you might receive in the mail. Talk to your accountant. You're going to hear some maybe differing opinions, but our opinion is if you're not getting a 1099, we're going to treat it similar to airline miles on the cashback scenario. The second thing is, first, those airline miles are tax-free and yada yada, and then we talked about the 2% you're getting back. The third issue is, can Mike deduct that 1.87% or whatever it is in credit card fees? Now, this is where it kind of goes from white to gray to black. And this is where Matt has coined the, 50 shades of gray of tax deductions. Mm-hmm. There's going to be different shades of gray here. So,
yeah.
First, if whenever
Don't
you
recommend
use a credit
book,
card
though.
In your – Yeah, yeah. See the movie. It's better than the book. I'm just playing around. Okay, all right. So just joking. Jen's listening now. I'm just joking, Jen. Okay, so Mike, everybody listening, whenever your credit card is used for business, all of those credit fees are a write-off. That's white, clear, fact, easy schmeasy. So credit card fees for a credit card in your business are always a deduction. Easy schmeasy. Then you start using maybe that credit card for some personal expenses, or you use that, blend that credit card for a lot of different things. Now it's getting hazy and it's getting a little gray. And we're like, meet with our client. We're like, what the heck's going on? What's this credit card really used for? And then tax payments can be tricky, because if you're using that credit card to make tax payments directly related to your business, then that's pretty bright line white. We're good. You're going to take a write-off for those credit card fees. But when you're making estimated tax payments on your 1040, now we have to say, all right, this is your 1040, but that income was generated solely from a business, and those taxes are related to my personal 1040, but I've got a pass-through business income, and those taxes I'm paying are related to my business, and that's a business debit card or credit card, and I'm getting, oh. Now we get into this gray area where I really think it's a decision for you and your accountant to say, how aggressive do we want to be? So I'm going to say, in summary, the more those tax payments are directly related to your business, the more comfortable I feel writing off the credit card fees. The less they're related to business income and maybe to just personal income in 1040, those credit card fees would not be deductible. And the answer sometimes lies somewhere in between. So talk to your accountant, find out your risk tolerance, his or her risk tolerance, and that would be my recommendation. Matt, do you want to add anything to that? Am I out in right field on some of that? No, yes.
I mean, it was reason judgment. I know about the miles, but I and the cash back, I haven't looked into that before. So I'm glad you fielded that question. You're a good dude. Okay. You fielded that question. I would have bombed.
Well, Mike, I hope that helps. So I think 90% of it you're doing okay. I just confirm on where you want to go on those credit card fees based on the type of payment.
That helps me tremendously. I think I will avoid it just to avoid any potential issues, because I just don't like walking on the edge. So I think it helped me out tremendously, but I think other fees, such as, like I said, we're a hotel and we collect taxes for when people stay at the hotel.
Oh, yeah.
Those kind of fees I'm going to go ahead and pay with the credit card and earn the 2%, I think. And that would be just pass-through fees that I'm actually giving back to the government.
Yeah, I'm with you. And again, it's interesting you said that. It's somewhere in the middle. So I like you're going to choose certain taxes to pay with a credit card, maybe certain blatant, obvious personal taxes. You may not. But when they're deductible, you will. And so I like that you're finding that middle ground where you feel comfortable and honest and integrity. So, all right. Well, Mike, thank you. Enjoy Iowa.
Sure.
Woo.
Appreciate it. And you guys are amazing.
Oh, you're so kind. Now that my wife's listening, that's good that you said that. I'm going to make a special note of that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Mike, you're great. Mike, and it's listeners like Mike we really appreciate there. Okay, this is good. Okay, do you want to fill? I know you got a lot of IRA questions. We got Jennifer in Texas on hold.
I got a non-IRA
Jennifer
one.
Jennifer in Texas.
I got a good.
Okay,
I got a non-IRA one.
Hit out a
throw in the mix.
Okay, throw in a quickie.
All right, this is from Brian in Las Vegas, talking about the payroll matrix. I believe he's referring to the Kohler payroll matrix. He said they got an electrical contracting company. We are an LLC, taxes, and S-Corp. Last year, company net earnings were $312,000. Our total payroll was $343,000 for six full-time employees, including me, who all earn between $45,000 and $65,000. My personal W-2 was $52,000. His question is, does the payroll matrix, the amount of salary taken, does that amount take into account only what the owner of the company is taking or total payroll of the company? So this is a great question. Now, remember on the numbers there, Brian's W-2 payroll that he took was $52,000, and he had net earnings of $312,000 passing through. Now, he had a much higher payroll of $343,000 because he's got a lot of other, electricians probably working for him, staff. So the short answer is you do not get to count the payroll of all your other employees. The IRS is going to be looking at what your W-2 was and focused on that in relation to the net earnings. So those are the two numbers to be looking at, the profit or net earnings, and then your W-2 amount. So, and
yeah,
you might be a little low on your W-2. That's what I'm just going to say now, and on the numbers you gave of $52,000 when you're at $312 net earnings.
Yeah, could be a little low. And I would say this a different way, because sometimes people hear that and go, what? When you calculate your payroll as the owner of the company, and we're not talking about spouse or children, that's a whole other story, but we're talking about at the end of the day, after all the expenses, the payroll matrix is trying to give us guidance on what your payroll should be in relationship to the profit of the company as a whole before you take your payroll. See what I'm saying? So if Matt says, well, the net profit in those numbers was $300,000, and then your salary was $50,000, well, your net profit before salary was $350,000. So we're going to take that $350,000 and put it into the matrix and go, what should your payroll be in relation to that total amount of profit? And then we run with it. Then we're going to have separate analyses for your spouse or your kids. But the payroll for your employees is what it is. That's just an expense of doing business.
Yeah.
The IRS isn't going to tell you how much to pay people. Don't worry about that. We're just worried about your payroll to keep you out of hot water, because you want to take the lowest amount of payroll to pay the least amount of FICA and get the biggest 199A deduction. And so the IRS knows you're going to try and screw them over. So that's why they're trying to hold you your feet to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to throw this out too, because this was an email question related to some of our other stuff. Jason was asking about the AB5 issue in California as a 1099 independent contractor. Jason, I'm going to let you know we're producing a blog article on that for next week. And on our next open forum, we'll probably talk about that even more. But I just want to say this to everybody living in California. If you're paying subcontractors, paying employees, or you are a subcontractor in California, there's a new law. And it's all about when you cross that line from employee to subcontractor. So it's tricky. Jason, we're not ignoring you. We've just got some other things in the works. Okay, we're going to jump over to Jennifer on the line in Texas. And we've got so many clients in Texas. Someone asked yesterday, like, Mark, where are you going to do your next live workshop? And I said, we ought to do it in Texas, because we've just got so many clients down there. And I want to go to Bucky's. So it's a big deal. So,
yeah, that's why everyone goes. That's why everyone goes.
Yeah. Do you live by it, Bucky's, Jennifer? Do you live by Bucky's?
Not far. It's not far.
Oh, you go all the time?
About 30 miles.
You staying
so
out
come
there
to
on
Austin.
Friday? Okay. It's Friday night when you go to Bucky's. You're like, let's just go get some barbecue and hang out at Bucky's.
No, we have plenty of other barbecue places that we go to.
Okay. All right, whatever.
Mark, this is
okay,
like someone asking you about, like, do you just go to the side of the road to buy your potatoes from the farmer? You know, I don't – do people in Texas, are they proud of Bucky's? Is it really a thing? I've only heard it from Mark Kohler, so I'm just curious.
I don't – I mean, we go by whenever there is one nearby, but
okay.
We're kind of scattered. They're not really near me too much, so no, we don't go out of our way or anything.
Yeah, but you're proud of it.
Okay.
You want to claim it. You're like, Texas. I'm proud of Bucky's.
Okay.
You want to own it, Jennifer. You got to own it. You only got so much. It's hot. It's buggy. You got the Texas.
Don't feel pressured.
I get it, but you know, yeah, don't feel pressured.
It's beautiful.
Okay,
here.
All right, Jennifer, you've got, it is beautiful. Okay, you got two S corporations. Tell us what's going on.
So 10 years ago, I've always been in real estate and just as a fun side gig, and I created an LLC, two of them. I have four properties, two in each, and I opted to be taxed as an S-Corp. I've been living 10 years now, and I'm finally to a point where it's profitable. So I've heard, and now listen to you, that this is a bad thing, and I don't know why it's a bad thing. I'd love to educate myself as to what I've gotten myself into. And then also, what I have never taken a salary for the profit, especially in 2019. What problems have I just created for myself, and how do I get out of it? Is it easy? So essentially,
okay.
It's like,
okay,
what did I do to myself?
Well, okay, well, let's figure it out. Now, two questions real quick. With these S-Corps, you're not getting commissions. You're not acting like a realtor. You're not fixing, flipping, and rehabbing.
No.
They're just for your four rentals.
Yes.
Okay, just rentals. Okay, just rentals. Okay, maybe I don't have a second question then because I was going to have a follow-up. Okay, so Matt, can I pontificate for a moment?
Yes.
And then you'll add the fringes here, the window dressing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Jennifer, I'll say it this way. It can be a bad thing because of the following reasons. And everybody listening, let's just put this in perspective. We like LLCs on our right side of our matrix or our structure diagram for holdings and S corps on the left side for operations. We normally don't put our holdings across that wall over on the left side into our S corporations. Now, here's a few reasons why, Jennifer. First, if you want to do a 1031 exchange and sell one of them and roll it into another property, and you may have partners, you may have a unique situation with lending, and for some reason you've got to take the property out of the S corp, you have to pay the tax on the appreciation, even if you're just transferring it to yourself. So this 1031 exchange, transferring assets into your estate, maybe you're going to partner with someone, maybe you're going to do a refi, and you're going to deed it out and refi and put it back. All of that flexibility is gone with the S-Corp. Now, the S-Corp's great. The S-Corp's great for operations, but we typically don't like the S-Corp for holdings and these rental properties because you kind of put some handcuffs on yourself. Now, are you paying more tax right now? Nope, you're good. Can I get the 199A deduction now that you're making profit? You bet. Do you still get depreciation? Sure. And do you have to take a salary? No, because it's passive income. So you're okay. You're still getting your tax write-offs. You don't have to do a salary. But the first problem, I'm going to give you a second one, but the first problem is flexibility. They're stuck in that S-Corp until you're ready to freaking sell them. And you can't do much without incurring a possible tax. It's called a built-in gains tax. So typically when I have a client that's stuck rentals in an S-Corp, they're kind of there till the day you sell them. And that's okay. It's just know in the back of your mind, you're not going to be able to be too creative with financing and partnering and transferring and 1031s without maybe some hurdles to jump through. So that's the problem. That's number one. Number two,
okay.
You've got an S-Corp tax. And any follow-up on that, Jen? Does that make sense, thoughts or comments on that?
It makes sense, but I've actually took one of the properties out and refinanced it and put it right back in. And did I, mess up? Because evidently I did. But if you have a gain on the sale, doesn't the S-Corp have a loss that it would offset it? Which also
so you're saying
flows
you had carry forward loss? Well,
No. What I'm saying is I actually took it out of the S-Corp and refinanced it and then put it right back in. So you, from what I understood, that you just said that there would be a personal gain on that, that I had to pay some sort of built-in tax, or I didn't hear, I don't know what you
okay, yes.
called it.
And this is a big topic, and in fairness to all of our listeners, I'm going to just summarize, and if you're like, ooh, that didn't click. Once this is ripped and back on iTunes, you might want to listen to this again or just do a little consult with your accountant or our office. But let me repeat it this way. You brought up two different issues. When you transfer the property out, if you got audited by the IRS, they would want to calculate what's the fair market value today, what's your basis, and what's the gain. And if you were under audit, they would have made you pay tax as if you sold the property. So when you transfer it out to yourself, it's like you sold it. See, a corporation is an entity. It's not you. It's a corporation. So if you give it to yourself,
it flows through. But so, whatever gain I had, I also had a corresponding loss, didn't I?
Well, I don't – okay, that's the second issue. So just keep in mind, number one issue is when you transfer it out, you got to capture the gain from fair market value to basis. Okay, let's just know that. Now, if you got away with it, your accountant didn't catch it or no one cared, that's cool. It's not the end of the world. If you don't get audited, no harm, no foul. I'm just saying that it's exposure because the IRS would want to do that. Now you say, well, Mark, let's say worst case scenario that happens and I have a gain.
Well, it's just going to flow through to me. And I go, okay, what's your carry forward loss that you've been capturing? Well, it's 50 grand. Well, what's the gain? 100. Okay, so sure, you got to cash in on some of your losses, but your losses typically aren't going to add up to exactly the gain at fair market value. So you don't just get to take it off the books at your basis. You got to take it off the books at fair market value and pay the gain as if you sold it to someone tomorrow. And so your sure, you got a loss in there, but is that loss going to completely wipe out the gain on the pass-through? I don't know. And so that's the risk. So in summary again, and I know you've got a good follow-up question or two, but this is where a consult would come together, is that you want to think about, man, I got to be careful because I don't have the flexibility I want. And yeah, I've got carry forward losses, but I got a potential built-in gain and da-da-da-da. So that's the problem with S-Corps number one. Number two problem, just quickly here, and thanks, Jen, for your patience, is the cost of a tax return. You got to do two freaking tax returns, two 1120Ss. Now, you may have the cheapest accountant in Austin, Texas, and they're knocking them out for $300, $400, $500. But S-Corp tax returns aren't usually cheap. A LLC is a pass-through entity with protection but no tax return. So now you can just throw them on your 1040. You just get the same asset protection as a corporation, but you don't have the cost of those two extra tax returns. So if you said, Mark, for the last 10 years, I've been doing these two S-Corp returns, no wonder your accountant hasn't told you it's a bad thing. He's been charging you for two tax returns for 10 years. Do the freaking math. So we would have, on the outset, wanted to get you protection, but not the cost of all that administration. So that's the second problem. So
gotcha.
Anyway, what's done is done. It's not the end of the world. It's just, you know, now you know. And when you sell these properties one by one, just don't put the replacement in the S Corp. Let's set up a sister LLC and start throwing them in there and get rid of those S Corps. That'd be my recommendation. All right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Jennifer.
It. Thank you.
Keep listening. Thank you. All right, Matt, we got about 2 or 3 minutes. And everybody that sent in a question, I know you're frustrated. You're like, where are the A's answers? So, Matt, I'm going to let you rapid fire. You choose whatever quick questions you want to answer in the last 3 minutes here.
Yep, I got a good one from Gene. The Gene wrote in and said, what corporate minutes would look like for a one-man band S corporation? How and when should it keep them, and what should they consist of? This is a great question. We do have our company maintenance program special coming on right now. If you want to be on our program, we do your minutes for you, handle your renewal for you, have a questionnaire that gets all the questions out that you should be putting in your minutes. And let me tell you, it's an awesome service. I use it myself for my own entities. And you can go to kkslawyers.com. It's on the homepage there. Even if you see what we do and then want to do it yourself later, yeah, $100 is on the special. You do it later yourself if you think it's so easy and want to do it yourself. But let me answer your question. Generally state if there's any changes in the ownership, address, officers. If it's all just the same, just say that. Nothing's changed. You want to talk about any significant transactions that have happened. You've got a new significant new business. You bought a new property. Those types of things. Open new locations. Open different banks. You know, you can – those are the things you'd outline in there. But really just think of significant things that happen in your business. That's the biggest general thing. Anything big that happened in the business – put it in the minutes, record what happened. This is a record-keeping function of what's going on in the business.
Yeah. We've got 25 questions on our maintenance program that we give to you, and then you can do them yourself. Then we type them up and make them look pretty and hold your meeting. And I would just say this, probably we won't be able to fill another question, but I'll say this too. All of you single owners out there, one-man band show, treat yourself nice. Go out to a nice dinner. Get a steak. I mean, this is a tax-deductible dinner. I don't want you going to Taco Bell and knocking this out. I mean, let's do it right. Ruth Chris, Mastro's, something real nice. And give yourself
right.
the Uncle Eddie present, something real nice.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, well, so.
I want to get something for you, Clark.
Yeah. Something real nice. So.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, everybody.
No last
Matt,
thing.
Take us out. I've been talking.
I know. I was just going to say thanks, everybody, for listening. Get to refreshwealth.com to sign up for the newsletter if you're not already on it. We give you lots of information about upcoming shows and have tax deadlines and articles in there. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.